And one can say lots of other things. So the reason why symplices are important is, of course, that one can find affine functionals. That is to say, one can find sets of parallel hyperplanes, which you can imagine being like, you have a random variable. I mean, this is basically why these parallel hyperplanes can be found such that there's one of them passes through one of the points, and another one in the same family passes through all the other corners. This is really why simplices are used in probability theory over n mutually exclusive events. So the quantum version of n mutually exclusive events, then you use something much more sophisticated. Instead of a simplex, you use a convex body, which is a set of all density matrices, namely all phase 1 n by n matrices, such that they are positive. So that's what replaces the simplex. And this is a very funny body. It has a dimension of this body is n squared minus 1. But the dimension of its set of corners, of its pure states, is only, it's much smaller. But it's still a continuous manifold. The symmetry group, of a simplex is, of course, just a permutation group. The symmetry here is SUN, which is a quite small subgroup of the group of all rotations. This could be some subgroup of SUN. And the main point, of course, is that the pure states form still, just like the corners of the simplex, they form a set of measures zero in the outsphere of this body, which means this body is difficult to, I mean, it's considerably difficult to see this body, so to say, in front of one. The simplex is still there because,
permutation in Sn and corresponds to an orthogonal rotation on the simplex. Say Sn as a subgroup of SOS?
Yes. Any kind of permutation of the corners can be done.
Right. And that's obvious, or?
It doesn't seem obvious to me, for example, for the four simplex, right? Like it seems
sorry.
Okay.
I apologize. And here you should, of course, really include anti-human pairs. And now it is clear, and in fact, it has been known close to 2,000 years in this session. Yes, thank you. Anyway, in this body, the simplices with n corners, since this is n mutually exclusive events, are still there. So it admits n minus one dimensional cross sections, continuously many, which just look like simplices. So you get the simplices as cross sections of this body. And moreover, this is not just a cross section, it's also a shadow of the whole thing, which means that if you project the body orthogonally to such an n minus one plane, you just fill up, the complexity. Nice. Now I make a break for notation. Yeah, actually, all of you know this, right? Usually. different audiences, and this perhaps tells. So notation. To go from Hilbert space to this space in which the density of the matrices sit. So the idea is that if you have a matrix, which is summation, then that's an element in this real vector space. Well, I'm assuming that the trace is one. And whenever I see a matrix, which is summation and has trace one, I introduce a vector here. So I use vector notation. So I use lowercase letters. And what I do, I turn it into a traceless matrix. So I subtract the maximal mix state like that. So that's my notation, so to say. And the scalar product of two vectors in this space is defined to be 1/2 of the trace of the corresponding matrices. If I start in Hilbert space, and if I have a vector in Hilbert space, then I first turn this into a projector. And in this notation, then, this corresponds to a vector like this. So this is really the embedding, if you like, of complex projective space, actually, into R squared minus 1. OK, so this is my notation for my vector notation for R n squared minus 1. And I use it quite freely. So whenever I have something lowercase and underlined, it's actually a matrix, but it's treated like a vector. Pardon?
In the end, it wasn't the identity.
No, it was the maximal mix space.
Oh.
It's something to make it trace.
OK, but what do you have in front of it? 1/2? I just can't read your symbol.
Oh, sorry.
Your vector m above, I see what you
do. Oh. I usually write it myself like this. But then I thought I shouldn't burn you with that notation, so I wanted to write it like this.
So you wrote
which it. Which I didn't do, I admit. Sorry. I seem to be rather inaccurate. Now, OK, so we don't understand the shape here, except that it somehow has to do with the synthesis. And of course, also now the sick and mud questions are, in a way, questions about the shape of the body of density matrices. And you can formulate this question, as you know, in Hilbert space. Because, I mean, so here we're looking for vectors, which are such. And here we're also looking for components for our which is quite an elegant statement of the problem, so to say. This set of n squared vectors like this defines a sick. And here you have n squared plus n vectors, which define a complete set of maps. Oh. So you're looking for n plus 1 orthonormal basis, such that and this is an elegant statement of the problem, so one could work from here, or one can translate it into R n squared minus 1. And in this case, a sieve is simply a regular simplex with n squared corners. And here what you have is n plus 1, n minus 1 simplex, or n plus 1 copies of a simplices regular n corners. And they're placed in n plus 1 totally orthogonal planes of dimension n minus 1. So you have some picture of a complete set of maps, n plus 3 like this. And in this case, you have four totally orthogonal planes. So any vector in this plane is orthogonal to anyone in that. And in each of these planes, each of these planes is centered at the maximally mixed state. And in each of them, you have a regular syntax. And this works. You can always do this because the total dimension is precisely n plus 1 times n minus 1. But we haven't got to the problem yet. In both cases, there is this additional requirement that all, so we have two convex polytopes that we can construct trivially, but then we also require that all corners are pure states. And since the pure states form a set of measure zero on the out sphere on this thing, and since they have the same out sphere, this means that you have to rotate the thing until it fits into the set of measure zero. And that's the difficult part. So these convex polytopes are supposed to be inscribed in the body of density. And that's then the problem. Okay. So can one do this? So the belief is that the seek probably can be constructed for any n. These certainly can be constructed if n is a prime or a prime power. So they seem to be. I should perhaps comment on this. So that leaves all other dimensions open. And I've actually been working on this quite a bit myself. I mean, can one find a complete set of maps in six dimensions? And I was quite agnostic about it. And until this summer, when I read a paper by Brierly and Weigert, which to me seemed rather convincing evidence that it happens. So I now believe that you cannot use any other dimension. But Marcus Grassen was a bit critical of it. So maybe I shouldn't give up so quickly, I don't know. But anyway, there's a serious paper which suggests that perhaps. And before I proceed, I'll do something which I do quite because of my limitations, but I will fix my n. I'd be interested in the relation between six and maps. No, okay. Yeah, let me do it right away. So from now on, I fix my dimension to be a prime and moreover an odd prime. If I don't do that, essentially everything I say will have to be modified, or I have to send what happens when I receive it also. It will make the twice as long talk. So I fix this just for simplicity. Now, a big difference here, of course, is that here there is a very elegant sort of combinatorial theory which gives this sort of construction, which gives the known maps. It's very elegant. Here are many constructions, they just look like very strange accidents whenever I look at one of these things, especially this thing you showed during your talk. It's just that by now there are about 50 of those. I don't know how many, there are many of these accidents that happen. And when 15 very strange accidents happen in a row, you begin to think that there's a reason why they happen. So that's one sort of, say, difference between these problems. Here's a very elegant theory, and I don't know anything useful. The next funny thing happens when you look at the symmetry group, these constructions. Okay, so the symmetry groups of the polytopes are, of course, rather large. I mean, here you have S n squared, which is a very big group. But if you look at the symmetry group, which is a symmetry of both, whatever it means you're looking at, the polytope and the body of density matrices. So the symmetry group of the polytope inscribed to the body of density matrices. Here you have a nice convenient symmetry group, which is a semi-direct product of the Bayer-Heisenberg group, and then the symplectic group, a symplectic group, or if you want to include anti-unitaries, it's a bit big. So there's an elegant symmetry group here that squares with that. The funny thing is that the same symmetry group appears here, it's just that here you have the Bayer-Heisenberg group, seems to be a possible symmetry group here. And then it's a semi-direct product for some reason with one of the group elements here, which cubes the union. So somehow this group here seems to be reappearing here, or is reappearing here, but in a rather strange way.
The symmetry group is for the MUBs and
in prime power dimension these would be different versions actually.
Yes, it would. But I already made this restriction, so you're not
vice prime.
Okay. Yes.
So you think this is a symmetry group of both things?
Well, this is, right? This is part of the symmetry. And then there is some strange but the whole thing here is not the symmetry of that. But for some reason there is an element in this group which is also symmetry.
But you wrote down ES ultimately because that's the symmetry group of the MUBs.
Yes, this is supposed to be, you know, it starts up there. It says MUB component, and then it's C here. The nice thing about this symmetry group is that one can easily see how it comes, provided one knows the elegant combinatorial construction. So let me just explain where this, how this symmetry group happens. It happens, of course. So for the MUBs, you have n squared plus n vectors. Or simply n squared plus n objects. Now there is a nice combinatorial object which involves n squared objects of one kind and n squared plus n vectors of the other kind, of some other kind, which is called an affine plane of order n. And this is constructed in such a way that you have n squared objects called points, and you have n squared plus n objects called lines. And each line is a subset of n points, and each point is a subset of n plus 1 lines. And the picture for that is that you draw the n squared points, just for n equals 3, and here's one of the subsets, which is a line. And here's another subset, which is a line. And here's another subset, which is a line. And here's another subset, which is a line. And then, if you like, you can regard the point as being this subset of lines that intersect in these points. Fortunately, you all know this, I guess. So I can... Usually my talks collapse at this point because I'm going to explain this. Now, to discuss this in terms of this vector space with n squared minus 1 dimensions, instead of, so I already have these objects, right? I have the n squared plus n objects that I'm interpreting as lines in the, but that's incidental. So I have these objects, and I take a subset, I call them P, which is a small letter version of a projector. And then I pick a subset And instead of working with subset, I simply sum over all the elements in the subset. And the sum is identified with the subset, which is going to be called a point. But to us now, it's just another vector in Rn squared minus 1. And because of the combinatorics, one can actually invert this one likes. So the sum also over a subset of p's, and you obtain one of the subset, one of the p's, like that. If you work out, so since these are specific matrices, and this is a specific matrix, it's a reasonably specific matrix in the sense that you know all the traces, all the relative traces, so to say. So I can check that the n squared Hermitian matrices you're painting this way actually have the property, because we know the traces of products of those from the size of the polytope. I can check that these things actually form a regular simplex in our vector space. They also happen to form an orthonormal basis in one dimension higher.
Can I ask you just explain the construction a little more?
Pardon?
Can I ask you just explain the construction a little more? What are the P underscore sub W's?
Okay.
Those are
constructed. Okay, so I have constructed my polytope in R n squared minus 1, which means that I have n squared plus n vectors, and I call them P.
And these are they're projectors, right? Is that
means? No, at this stage not. They're just the polytopes. So they're just vectors in R n squared minus 1. So they're emission matrices of trace unity, and they have a certain trace of one times another is something definite because of the polytope, because of the distance.
Right. But these are identified as projectors on pure states, like this.
Well, my idea now is that at the moment I haven't yet rotated the thing so that the corners are pure sets. They would be if I had succeeded in that. But at the moment I just have the polytope.
And then, but you're calling those things P, W down there, is that right?
Yes. Okay. Or actually I call them P only. Or something else.
And then this subset that you're summing over is a specific sort of subset?
Yes. I start with n squared plus n vectors, and because I happen to know that there is such a combinatorial structure, provided n is prime, or a prime power, then I know that I can divide these sets, this set, into subsets.
It's based on the inner products in this R that you
mean.
Which are based on the inner product between the vectors in the R in the real space?
I think I have given a confusing presentation. This is pure combinatorics. I have a set of n squared plus n objects, and I can divide them into n squared subsets containing n e. No, sorry, I can divide it into n. Yeah, a total of n squared subsets, each containing n of them, in such a way that these subsets have certain intersection properties, namely the intersection properties of the affine plane. So this is pure combinatorics. Now, if I decide to have this concrete realization of my n squared plus n objects, which are these vectors in Rn squared minus 1, whose scalar products are those that I have to form this regular polytope.
So you can write those vectors down in some basis. And the problem is that in the basis that you've chosen, they're not going to be pure states.
Right.
So you'd like to rotate them until they
are all.
But when you go to the combinatorial construction to PW, you have a rule that says something, right? I mean,
you can just
Well.
For the simplex, right? You start with an orthonormal basis in one dimension higher, and you just project out the uniform superposition of all of them, and you'll have a simplex in one more dimension. That would be one way to concretely build the piece for the sake of the not like it's a solid.
I understand you. I just want to know what the concrete, just the very basic, how does the concrete construction relate to the conformal construction?
Okay, now we're back to, in a sense, it's actually in a way easier the other way around because of the way, can I describe it the other way around? Because that would be easier. Okay, so let me, suppose I start from the other way around. Suppose I have an orthonormal basis of phase one in the Lie algebra. I have such matrices. I construct the corresponding vectors by subtracting. Okay, so I have n squared. Now I simply make an array. These are these n squared objects. It's easier to describe this way. Okay, and these are then. Okay, these are specific. To me, they happen to be specific matrices, but anyway, I have these n squared objects drawn as an array. Now I pick this subset, and I give it a name. I call it P1. This will now, if I do it completely, be a complete vector in Rn squared minus 1. And then I pick another subset which doesn't intersect, and another subject which doesn't intersect this subset. And then I can pick a subset like this, and there's a systematic way of doing that. I mean, the affine plane gives me a list of possible subsets. This list has n squared plus n elements. And they all have this property that either two subsets have one A in common, or else they have none N in common according to a specific pattern. Now, So if I construct my piece, my n squared plus n piece, according to this recipe, then what stands on the right here will have either one or none A in common. Because I know, but from this I can compute the scalar product. This gives me the scalar product between those. This means that since I know the scalar products between those, I can also construct the scalar products between those. And these scalar products will be such that this piece, given that this is a regular syntax to start with, that this will be a map follicle. This is, and it's all, I mean, this part is actually, I mean, well, once you have that combinatorial structure, this is straightforward. And you get the map polytope from a simplex in this way. You start with a regular simplex with n squared forms, and you get the regular map polytope. But the spectrum of these matrices are not under control. So you don't know if they correspond or if they sit inside the body of density matrices. So in effect, what we have here is we have, if you think about this, these formulas. So we start with a map. Okay, let me draw a map. For n equals 2, the map polytope actually is like this. Here's one orthonormal basis. This one goes to here, right? So here's another orthonormal basis, and here's a third orthonormal basis. So the map polytope, here are the map vectors, here are the p's, and the convex hull of these, in this case, six points, the convex hull of these will form the map polytope, which in this case is just a regular octahedron. So here are the symplices, and here's the map polytope. And what this construction actually does is each of these is actually one half like that. Or alternatively, I construct an A by summing a certain number of these vectors. So I sum these three vectors and I get an A. So what this construction actually gives me geometrically is that I inscribe the map polytope into the regular syntax. So the pure combinatorial structure leads to a construction where I inscribe one polytope into another, namely into a regular simplex. And now I can ask for the symmetry, still not caring about the spectrum of the operators, I can ask for the symmetry group of this pair of polytopes, the mud polytope inscribed into the regular simplex. So I do only such rotations and reflections that keep these things in place. And because I have this affine plane description of the thing in my back pocket, so to say, it's actually sort of assumed that you know this. The symmetry group, it has to take corners of the simplex into corners of the simplex, which translated into these terms means it has to take points in the affine plane into points of the affine plane. It also has to take the corners of the map polytope into corners of the map polytope, which translated into affine terms means that it has to take lines into lines. So we're looking for a group that transforms an affine plane into itself and that takes lines in the affine plane also in itself. So the symmetry group of these two coupled polytopes, so to say, is obvious. It's a general affine group acting on an affine plane. So the translation group is just set up. So that's the symmetry group of the two polytopes. And now we have, in a way, almost solved the problem of rotating this configuration in such a way that it's inscribed into the body of density matrices. If, namely, we happen to have read Weyl's, so in the 1930s, right, Hermann Weyl found that this group has an essentially unique unitary group for realization. It's actually with a face and so on. But this is the Weyl-Heisenberg group. If you want to realize this with unitary transformations, you have to use the Weyl-Heisenberg group. And that has a unique unitary irreducible representation in any dimension. And then there's a result from the 1960s by Weyl, who was a French mathematician, which says that once you fix that, then this has to be the normalizer of the Weyl-Heisenberg group in the unitaries. And this cannot quite be done. This group is a little bit too big. You actually have to restrict your symmetry group a little bit to SL. So you're looking at matrices with entries in which are integers modulo n, modulo p, that is to say. And you actually insist that alpha, the determinant, is 1. This much you can reproduce with unitary transformations. And if you allow anti-unitaries, you also put plus minus 1. So it's sort of a very well-established statement that the most you can have here as unitary transformations that can also be symmetries of the body of density matrices is this group. And this is precisely what we have here. Except that I put plus minus 1. And then everything from that point on is very easy because we have this unique unitary irreducible representation. The MUBS will actually be an eigenvector of a cyclic subgroup of the Weyl-Heisenberg group and so on. Yes, I do. When I rotate the thing so that it fits into the density matrices. Because then, before I did that, I was just looking for rotations and reflections that turn the thing into itself. But now I'm actually insisting that these rotations and reflections belong to the subgroup of rotations and reflections that also preserve the body of density matrices. So that means that I have to realize everything with unitary transformations. That's the problem of inscribing it into roles.
So, I mean, I guess there's projective representation. I don't know that maybe, but...
It's a projective representation. It's a projective representation. I mean,
yeah, it's a projective representation. But the Weyl-Heisenberg group has different irreducible complex representations.
What?
they differ by the central character, so it's not.
That's right. It's that's unique up to choosing a character.
Yeah.
The physicist would say for every mass, there's a
oh, okay. The Weyl-Heisenberg loop, if I remember the. It's either this or the other way around, it has two generators. I'm also insisting, perhaps, I mean, this is now a different set. I'm also insisting on this. So this will give me, so to say, cyclic transformations of the phase.
Yeah, but you can choose a different phase there. You can multiply that phase by some k, and then you get a different reducible representation.
I don't. I mean, okay. Does this change anything?
Well, I mean, it bridges your two remarks, right? So the projective representation is unique up to choosing a character. If you choose a different character, then you get a different irreducible representation. So if you count the number of irreducible projective representations of Zn squared in dimension n, you can actually d or d minus 1, how many n or n minus 1.
OK, but all these things will work the same on complex projective space, so they won't really change anything, will they?
It's probably true that they all, it may not matter which one you take when you take this semi-direct product. So I'm not totally certain about that. I think you might be able to start from any one of them and get the same, whatever that's called. That
I would have thought. I mean, at least I never heard of any complications at this point.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Well, okay, never mind.
Probably not support.
But they're essentially well up to choosing a character. I mean, we can talk about that.
Yeah. As elements of the rotation group, the Weyl-Heisenberg group is represented over this group, much bigger group, it's actually reducible. So the representation you obtain is a block diagonal thing of rotations in the n minus 1 place. So this, so to say, acts, the Weyl-Heisenberg group acts on the vectors, which is split into n minus 1 dimensional sets like that. And what it does is that it rotates in each of these independently. And it always leaves one of them fixed. Each element will leave one of them fixed. So each map is the eigenvector. Each map vector is the eigenvector of some element in it, or some cyclic subgroup of it. The elements of the symplectic group will be they will permute the map planes, and at the same time they will rotate. So it's some permutation matrix where each entry is an n minus 1 rotation. So this is how the representation of the symmetry group looks like in n squared minus 1 dimensions. Something to white platform.
There's one behind, there's one more top one.
Hmm? There are three levels.
Yeah. No, sorry,
I think so. How do I get these?
Raise that one, yeah. There's three levels.
Okay, so here's another level. Okay, let me say just one thing here which I sort of like. So the picture. Picture we have now, if I draw a picture of the A simplex and inscribed in this, I have this map polytope. So there are pure states sitting on the midpoints of the edges again, for two case. So the pure states are sitting there. And they're sitting on the out sphere of the body of density matrices. So this A simplex is a lot bigger. It doesn't fit. These are definitely not going to be true states because they're sitting outside. So the out sphere of the body of density matrix is on which the map vectors sit actually sticks out in n squared taps like this from the asymptotes. And it's a nice fact, which David Ross has shown, that all the pure, there are no pure states inside. Inside the asymptotes. Remember that the pure states form a set of measures zero on this sphere, which is sitting inside here. And actually, all of them are sitting on these caps that are bulging out from the asymptotes. It's all nice.
Wait, I'd like to understand.
Hmm?
What is the asymplex?
The asymplex is a regular simplex formed by these operators A.
By the Cyperbian?
No. But that brings us, of course, to 6, which we haven't yet got to.
Okay.
I mean, so what does it all this have to do with 6? So far, not.
Okay. But so this picture, is that valid for n equals 2, or does this picture emerge in any dimension, that you can inscribe another simplex or another inside?
This construction of the Mach polytope inscribed into a regular simplex works for any n for which an affine plane of order n exists.
Okay.
And the answer to that, incidentally, is not known. It's probably only prime powers, but nobody knows.
So the corners of this polytope, they correspond to pure states, right?
Right. Then when we rotate the thing to fit into the body of density matrices, then you have an additional problem. So even if you had constructed these polytopes inscribed into each other in, say, 12 dimensions, which if an affine plane of order 12 exists, could be done, we still don't know whether we can rotate the thing into, and this discussion of symmetry groups was too simplified anyway, wouldn't work at this thing.
If I translate what you just said there, something like the single pure state is both positive linear distribution are elements of mu.
That's
a translation?
I deliberately formulated the theorem in such a way that this is what it says.
I was thinking about fragments, whether you meant me or the other David Cross, but no.
No, this is you. yes, but what does this have to do with 6? So we have a regular simplex, but it's far too big. It's sitting well outside the outsphere of the body of density matrices. So does this simplex, this regular simplex that comes from the mouse, have anything to do with the 6? That's the question. So that's sort of like the first question. And so the first thing you can do is you just shrink it using the trick that Chris showed yesterday or the day before. You just shrink it until it fits into the body, into the atmosphere, etc. So you just shrink it. You shrink the A simplex until it becomes as big as the C simplex. And then you do get the C simplex provided n is 2, which is pretty good. But it doesn't work for anybody else. Actually, in fact, if you just shrink this until it touches the atmosphere, then you hit the band. I just told you that there are no pure states here. So this cannot work for anything in order. This was way off. For n as an odd prime. This construction cannot work for odd primes, and in fact, it doesn't work for anything except n. So, what you can do.
I don't know.
What you can do is that you shrink it and you also invert it. So, you reflect this simplex through the origin. Or invert it through the origin, and then you shrink it, or the other way around. That actually works for n equals 3.
Sorry, there's something more interesting going on here.
So sorry. Oh, hold on.
Something exploded.
Something exploded and hit me at
least. An assassin tried to take me out. Maybe we're closing in on a solution.
Yeah, the French algebraic geometers.
Yeah. We're sacrificing this. Okay. I think there's no major problem, so please.
But then it doesn't work, okay? So in order to turn this into a six simplex, you have to shrink it, you have to shrink it, and then you have to rotate it so very cleverly on so far nobody else. I mean, that's the other way of doing that. So what can man do? I mean, does this have anything to do with six? At this point, I was originally planning to discuss.
Yeah, the furthest one back doesn't move, actually.
There's one in the middle. That's reach one. Up.
Yeah, but he wrote on all, or he's written on all nine.
No, not on these two. Not in the center.
Yes, yes.
Let me make this white. Since this seems to be developing into a very long talk, let me skip something and go directly to something that I actually have nothing to say, really. But I did learn something from Marcus Appleby the other day, and I will describe this instead, because, I mean, so it's not my thing, but it's a very nice observation, at least. So we're going to use the maps to perform tomography of seeds. Which is as it should be, because originally maps were introduced to do quantum state tomography. So you can do tomography of seeds. That means, and I'm sorry that I cannot draw a simplex of the appropriate size, but suppose you have a seed simplex with n squared corners, n should be at least 3, and then you project it orthogonally to one of these map plates. So these are then, you project it, and as I told you, if you project it onto the basis, you will fit inside the simplex with n corners. And if n is 3, which is a somewhat general case then you'll see a shadow of the 6 simplex. You'll see this n plus 1 shadows, and the question is, what do they look like? And the surprising thing is, which I didn't really believe, and I mean, when you told me that I'd done this, I didn't believe it was a simple calculation, but it's actually a very simple calculation, so I can actually do it, provided I can use the result at one point. So the projection, when you cast the shadow, what you're actually doing is that you're taking this vector that represents a pure state, so this is one of the seed vectors, say, and when you cast the shadow, what you do is that you turn this into a, well, this is a formula, where, of course, these are the vectors E, A, right? So there are 3 of them in this case. So this is a formula that you use when you cast the shadow. And now we should really have show for different colors, but we don't have that.
No, there are colors here.
But it doesn't matter so much. We'll clearly end up with, well, if we do this for one of these points, we get a point here. And the question is, where do the other points end up? Oh, I can have 2 states in red. I don't suppose.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, but this was a little bit late in the day. Wonderful. So we take these pure states, and we project one of them, and we obviously end up somewhere. And the question is, where do the other n squared things end up using this formula? And the calculation goes as follows. What you have to do then is that you take, now I realize that the notation is 4 that I have here. So I project this into a, do a vector in this n minus 1 dimensional space like that, and let me call that psi, and this is the original c vector in n squared out here. So I project this thing into this vector, and this vector is my vector psi. It's the image of the c point here. And now I can take the scalar. Now I want to know what the scalar product between 2 of those is. And I want to see if they organize themselves into something nice. So I take, let's say that one of the, this is, let's say this is the image of the fiducial vector. And then I take this scalar product with the image of any other vector.
So you're assuming about Heisenberg symmetry?
Yes. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't. Yes.
Wouldn't have.
No, it wouldn't be reasonable not to assume that. So this is actually using this formula for the projection. This is the sum AB and the scalar product. We involve these scalar products. And then there will be dA sine f squared, and then dB sine ij squared. And of course, this thing here is dB times these things. I'm ignoring, well, my face, something this. But now each of these vectors is the eigenvector of a cyclic subroutine by Heisenberg group. Let me, for simplicity, assume that I'm projecting onto the standard simplex. Then this vector is actually an eigenvector of this thing. And this is actually equal to this. Which means, you see, that I get only n points. And this is true regardless of whether I'm using a seek or not. This will be true for any orbit of the Heisenberg block. There are n squared points originally, but they collapse into n points when you cast the shadow. Right. Now this scalar product is known because we're sitting inside the simplex. So these scalar products are known. If they're the same, they will actually be the way I normalize it. The way I normalize it, this is n minus 1 over 2 n, and if they're different, it's minus 1 over 2 n. Minus 1 over 2 n, yes. So these are these scalar products. This ensures that this simplex has edge length 1. So if you use this formula here now, and that, then what you're actually going to get is 1 over 2 n times the sum. And when all these are equal, you're going to get this. And here I actually subtracted off, I added this thing. And I include this in the rest of the sum, which means that the rest of the sum is unrestricted. So this piece in the scalar product is put into this sum. So this becomes an unrestricted sum over A and B of dA squared. And because this is now an unrestricted sum, this piece is actually equal to 1. This piece, to make a long story short, this piece is 2 over n plus 1, yes. This thing here is equal to 2 over n plus 1 for a CH. Not for any orbit of the Heisenberg group, but for a C. This comes out, you have to look at the frame potential, which is some quadratic expression and such things. It's a quartic expression, well, just like this one. And this is so. I can in principle show this, but this happens to be so. So here we're using something trivial, here we're using something non-trivial, which is true for seeps, and perhaps for something else, but it's certainly true for seeps. And this means, if you put this in here, and put this one here, and work it out, what you actually get is actually get is n minus 1 over 2 n, 1 over n plus 1, if I is equal to 0, and we get minus 1 over 2 n over 1 over n plus 1, if I is non-zero. That's the difference here. Sorry. If I is 0, and it's actually 1 over n plus 1, if I is non-zero, that's also not as much, right? I think. I can get confused whenever I not only the black box. Right. And this is simply the radius squared of the out sphere, and this is the radius squared of the in sphere of a regular simplex. Except that this simplex is now smaller than it used to be. These scalar products between these vectors of the shadow vectors is precisely this is a regular simplex. Which is such that the out sphere of the whole thing divided by n plus 1. Out sphere squared, the radius squared of its out sphere. So that was the tomography, and now I also ran short. But the statement is that the shadow will always be some regular simplex sitting inside here. And this for all I know about this, they will all have the same size. Like this. And the size is such, that was why I brought up this Fock-Fermi formula there. The size of the shadow is such, the shadow simplex has an out sphere touching the midpoints of faces in the original simplex of dimension. Or I didn't write it, but I think I remember it. It's n minus 1 over 2. Which means that for n equals 3, the out sphere is like this. The out sphere of the shadow simplex is just touch. It is completely inside. That for n bigger than 3, it sticks out. Which means that for n bigger than 3, there are already some sort of restriction on how the seed simplex can sit, because we better ensure that its shadow doesn't stick outside. So this was Marcus' story. I hope I didn't completely mishandle it. I think this is very nice. The question sort of is whether one can, if one looks at, I tried yesterday with not very good results, right? The question is if I can look at this sufficiently long and see that it's completely obvious or not. But to me, at the moment, it's not.
No, it's not obvious to me.
And as long as it's not completely obvious, it means that it strongly suggests that there is a connection between six and mouse. Of course, this is just, in some sense, because of this, it's the same group. We're looking at a specific group for the six, and it's the same group. But this is nice. Now, I have thought for an hour, right?
I have a question. It's hard for me to relate this picture with the more algebraic approach that Marcus used the other day.
No, I mean, he does the same calculation for me. The actual
calculation. Yeah, I guess so.
It's not what I, there's nothing to do with what I did in my talk.
No, it's nothing to do with his talk. Because he had many things to talk about, so he talked about one of those things, and then I talked about one of the other things.
Okay. I mean, I see similar numerology popping up, like 2 over n plus 1, 1 over n plus 1.
I mean, there are a limited number of ways.
No, seriously, it's the exact same numbers that show the spectrum of the CJKs or whatever.
The n plus 1 here is coming from the fact that if you take a seek vector, the block vector corresponding to the seek, it's got the same projection onto each of the n plus 1 hyperplanes. And because it's normalized to have length 1, that means the projections must all have length root over n plus 1. So it's
okay.
It's got a simple. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what I said on my talk was about seeks too, so I guess there would be connections by definition remote.
Did you have, sorry, maybe I interrupted you at the end of your talk, or, sorry, are you continuing?
I mean, my original plan, what I wanted to talk about, was really not at all Rn squared minus 1, but one can try to look at the thing in Hilbert space, for example. And there is this elegant relation to the elliptic curves. But my original plan also included the idea that I would work very hard on this last week, and I didn't. So maybe it's just as well that I'm out of time.
Today and the next 2 days are very much more open-ended, so if you'd like to tell us more about elliptic curves or something.
I know very little about it myself, but I do have one amusing thing. Let me just mention one thing. So the original construction of Mux for 5 dimensions is actually from 1886.
1886?
Yes.
That's when my house was built.
And it's in a paper called The Symmetries That Transform Elliptic Curves Into Themselves, written in French and in Italian. And it's the same group here. And for n equals 3, I already pointed out that n equals 3, it seems really come from us. For n equals 3, you also get the seeds from that thing.
Nice.
But you don't for n not equals 3.
So what was the subject of that paper?
It's rather hard to read, I should say. There's a more modern paper by someone called Bulleck, who does everything completely explicitly. He considers an elliptic curve, that is to say an embedding of a solid in a complex projective space. And then he looks at symmetry. Now I'm almost stuck on this.
So, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a 5-minute break for coffee? And
I have 2 questions.
The one objection is that maybe I then build up expectations, and I have very little to say about this.
I think that's okay. I think that's okay. You have a question first.
Yes, so you said there's something special with dimension 3, and we know that there are infinitely many finitial states in dimension 3.
Yes.
Can you explain this?
No, but it's a little bit tempting to say that you can already begin to... I did have a picture of that, which I wiped out, did I? Yeah. So what was special for n equals 3 is that if you just invert this A simplex, so you just go straight down here, then you hit one of these caps where you know there are pure states, and in fact there is a pure state. So the connection between MUFs and seeks are very straightforward. You just take the things and then you just invert it and get the seek. Then there is actually a one-parameter family of MUF fiducials. And somehow it's a little bit tempting to say that this is a little bit related to n equals 3 is when you cast the shadows, n equals 3 is very special in 2 ways. For one thing, the out sphere of the shadow always fits into the simplex. You don't have to bother about it, so it's more trivial, so to say. And the second thing is that actually any orbit of the Heisenberg group will form a regular simplex for n equals 3. So somehow you get from this construction an impression that n equals 3 should be much more relaxed, so to say. And in fact, it is much more relaxed. There are plenty of seats. You can rotate this symmetry. This is actually a possible solution for n equals 3. You could, but it's not the one I described by saying you just mean.
The 1886 paper, was it just relating maps to elliptic curves in dimension 3 or in other dimensions?
Now, his paper was a generalization to arbitrary prime dimension of a paper by Hesse from 1842.
Is this the Lane Houston? This is in some way.
I thought perhaps before I exaggerate, I mean, so Segre didn't have the notion of a scalar product. So he didn't really care about how far they were from each other and so on.
Well, Lane Houston has shown that being d equals 3 sigma of n is very closely related to the Hesse configuration.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're familiar with this?
Yes.
This was
in fact, this was what made me find this paper, because I actually saw a very nice video of Lane Houston giving a talk here, like, where unlike me, he draws a perfectly regular 12 dom and starts kind of shooting them. And that made me interested, so I thought.
But it didn't help you generalize it.
No, it didn't. But 2 weeks ago, I still thought that if I spent another week at it, I think. What I'm wondering is whether the construction that they had could be changed. Because the construction they had,
being who, sorry?
The Italians in the 19th century. Yes. What they had was the symmetries of their elliptic curves include an element of the symplectic group of order 2. Right. And we don't want that. We want an element of order 3.
Yes.
So maybe if I really knew that kind of stuff, I could modify the construction so that somehow an element of order 3 was. Mm-hmm. But that assumes that one really understands it.
Do you semi-understand it? I mean, I have no clue about elliptic curves or any of that, and I always wanted to have like a gentle introduction. Can you even talk about crudely for 10 minutes? That would already help me a lot.
I can blabber about it for 10 minutes.
That would be really, I'd be really interested in these 10 minutes.
Okay, so why don't we thank Ingemar? We'll go get some coffee. And without fear of embarrassment, you can explain to us everything that you know about elliptic curves that's really completely new to us, so we'll be shocked and amazed.